While our other panelists are making their way forward, let me introduce Scott Vaughan. His bio will tell you that he is the new Commissioner for the Environment and Sustainable Development in the Office of the Auditor General. And that is the outfit that cracks whips over the performance of recalcitrant government departments at the federal level. And he does it very well. He has a distinguished career which brings him to this point. He has worked in the political field. He has worked in the academic field. He has worked in the international environmental field, all at senior levels. Scott.
Referring to, so I'll keep close attention to it. First of all, let me thank Bob and the McGill Institute as well for organizing this. This has been I very much enjoyed the morning. I have several colleagues here, and we're working on a report that we're presenting to Parliament in the fall, looking at the federal responsibilities as well as implementation of freshwater management. We are also looking at a report on cumulative environmental assessments also being presented to Parliament in the fall, and we will probably be looking at oil sands and potential impacts on the Athabasca and other environmental issues from the assessment side on that. So this has been very helpful to me and also helpful to my colleagues here today. So the session right now is titled Water Governance in Canada. And it's obviously intentionally been bracketed between two ministers. We've just heard from Minister Prentice outlining some of the federal priorities, past actions, as well as what's on the books on Great Lakes, St. Lawrence, Port of Montreal, as well as the municipal effluents regulations that are coming into effect. And we will look forward to Minister Johnson in her dual capacity, both as Minister of Environment and Conservation of Newfoundland and Labrador, as well as the President of CCME. And Jim Bruce, I think, correctly said this morning when saying what are some potential bright spots on looking at one of the governance, among the governance challenges in Canada, the CCME, the acronym is the Council of, thank you, you all know, involving federal and provincial ministers, has set out some past Canada-wide standards as well as fairly new ambitious goals, which I'm looking forward to hearing from the minister. I'm sure you will as well. I just wanted to say by way of introduction, Steve Renzetti mentioned this morning a report that was published 25 years ago. It was the Pierce Report for many of you that followed that. And I think he correctly said that the issue of pricing that Peter Pierce had identified in that report has not been solved. I think it's also fairly safe to almost all the issues that were identified in that report, which to those of you and those of us working on freshwater issues remains a challenge. I think that many of the issues that were identified in that report remain with us today, and in addition, which look like things which are on the distant horizon, for example, climate change, 25 years later, have now magnified and present new challenges as well as compounding existing ones. We know from and hearing from the discussions this morning, there are lots of different pilots, lots of different models. There's been an explosion in the literature on governance in general, environmental governance, water governance in particular. There's been models that have been put into place on translating integrated water resource management from theory to practice. There's been different pilots on multi-jurisdictional cooperation at the basin or watershed level. However, here we are today, I think that one of the recurring themes that at least I heard from this morning was the gap between potential solutions and actual actions, or what can be characterized as a governance deficit. So with that, I'm very much looking forward to this panel on providing both some of the problems as well as I think some of the solutions that that they may have. And you have their bios, but I will begin with Rob Below. And Rob is the University Research Chair at Water Policy and Governance at the University of Waterloo and Director of the Multi-University Water Policy and Governance Group. Rob, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So it's a great pleasure to be here today. This is a really exciting venue, and there's a chance to catch up with lots of folks I've known for a while and lots of new people as well. So I'm very excited to be here, and thanks to the organizers for putting all of this together. I don't have any slides for you today, so as Madeleine said this morning, you will have to look at me. I'm not a complete Luddite, though. I am updating my Twitter feed as I'm delivering this talk here, so you can monitor me on Twitter. My hand is a little bit sore because I had to rewrite my talk at least three times this morning because many of the previous speakers were kind enough to deliver it for me. So I've had to adapt and be a little bit nimble here, so hopefully a coherent product results. So the panel, we're talking about governance today, and governance is a term that we've heard a lot, which I think is very good because I think it's a discussion that we need to be having in this country. Water governance. I'm going to keep the focus on a particular theme, though, I think, in my 8 minutes or so. I'm going to be speaking to questions of governance in terms of a national orientation or a national perspective. We've heard a lot about the need for a national strategy of some kind, so I want to talk about what that might actually mean, what it might actually look at. But you're going to see that I have to shift up and down scales because any kind of a national strategy is going to involve some sort of coordinated action at all scales. So why are we having this meeting, and why are we having all the other meetings that have been happening in the last couple of years and all the other meetings that are scheduled for the next few years? And I think we heard from Nick Nanos this morning that this reflects a substantial increase in general public awareness and understanding of the issues. We're all familiar with a lot of the scary hotspots and stories that we've heard. But I think more broadly, it reflects the fact that some of this is making its way into communities across the country, in communities all across the country. People are going about living their lives and slowly but surely starting to recognize that water availability is a concern. It's something they need to be worried about, whether it's water shortages or it's contamination incidents, or if you live in a small community and you're dealing with boil water orders. Your concern for water security in general is heightened. I think communities, citizens, governments, and firms are waking up to the fact that adequate access to adequate quantities of water of acceptable quality for people in the environment is by no means guaranteed in this country, even though we've had this myth of abundance that has been nicely shattered at this meeting here. And this is, of course, part of a growing concern around the world at all levels for the significance of water. So what does that mean for the topic of governance? When I say governance, I'm talking really about, I'm using the term quite broadly to refer to the countless different ways in which we organize ourselves as a society to make decisions that affect water. There's a vast palette of different ways of governing water, and the options and approaches have really changed in Canada, I think, in the last decade or so. And so I think it's important before we get into the question of, well, what would a coordinated national approach look like, to spend a few minutes on a slight tangent and look at some of the realities of water governance today. And I just picked three. There are lots of other ones. We could quibble about what's most important. But I think it's helpful to talk about things like the fact that I think complexity is, I would argue, significantly higher today than in previous generations, and for a whole variety of reasons. A lot more actors, for starters. So it's not just governments anymore, although, of course, governments are central and critical for the constitutional responsibilities and for other reasons. But we've got all kinds of other actors who have come to the table when it comes to governance, and we're talking civil society groups, water-using industries, Canada's Indigenous peoples, of course, banks and financial institutions, the insurance and reinsurance companies. The number and diversity of actors has increased, as has the number of interests, of course. More and different problems, I think, contributes to the complexity as well. All of the old problems that we faced forever in this country and haven't managed to solve yet are still here. Some of those are getting worse, but we have new considerations. Questions such as the provision of environmental flows, which weren't really on the radar a generation ago, are now a priority concern. And, of course, when you're starting to talk about providing water for the environment in regions that are already water scarce, inevitably what you're talking about is taking water away from somebody else. And as we heard this morning, this becomes a fundamentally political consideration. I think there are also more tools in the toolkit in terms of how we think about governance. So regulations, of course, as we heard this morning, are very important, but we're also exploring opportunities to use market-based mechanisms. Collaborative approaches are much more important. So that's one of the realities. The second reality, I think, is that the stakes are higher. I think there's increased pressure on water resources in areas where there traditionally has been pressure. And I think we're starting to see lots of more additional pressure in new kinds of places as well that haven't previously experienced shortages, for example. We have a serious risk of irreversible environmental damage if present patterns continue. And, of course, we have lots of reasons where we've already created permanent environmental damage. We have increased risk of economic disruption and reduced productivity in regions and communities and sectors. We're starting to make that water economy connection a little bit better. And, of course, you add to all of this, all the pressure that flows from the growth that we would experience anyways, add to that the complexity created by climate change, and you think that, that things get really kind of dicey for us. Now, paradoxically, I think, if our focus is only on the problems, I don't think we're going to get much traction. And I think that's been part of the problem in the water community. A lot of frustrated people in the water community believe, I suspect, that if we just reveal the problems more and in more detail, people will naturally start pursuing solutions. And I haven't seen a lot of evidence that that's the case. So I think it's helpful to also look at opportunities. And we have lots of opportunities, I think, that relate to water. So we heard some examples, for instance, of the markets for clean tech and smart water technologies that the Ontario government has identified. This is a theme the Conference Board of Canada has alluded to. We can start asking some questions if we're going to be a little bit more strategic about the potential for market opportunities that emerge from whatever water competitive advantage we might have in certain regions of Canada. Questions of our ability to help meet global demand for water expertise in terms of education and training. Can we harness the capacity that we have in our universities and colleges to meet some of that demand? I mean, I think that's an opportunity that if we were a little bit more organized, we could take advantage of. So how do we start addressing all of the problems we've identified, and how do we take advantage of those opportunities? Put another way, and I like the way Bob put it this morning, how do we get moving while we still have some room to move? So how do we get moving before the crisis hits? Now, lots of people have called for a national water policy or strategy of some kind at this conference. It's been a little bit of a theme, actually. I think this reflects fairly widespread support from organizations that have been busy on this file for a few years. The Canadian Water Resources Association, the Forum for Leadership on Water, Pollution Probe, just to name three of many organizations that have been pushing some kind of an agenda for a coordinated national action. I think a Canadian national water strategy could be an effective way to address a lot of the governance challenges that relate to the situation we have now, which we've all established is really quite fragmented and lots of ad hocery going on. But I'm not in favor of just any Canadian water or national water strategy. I'm not in favor of a Lord of the Rings, one ring to rule them all kind of strategy, all-encompassing, top-down and cumbersome. And I don't think that's the answer. I don't think that'll allow us to be as nimble and flexible as we're going to need. I think what we need is a Canadian national water strategy that facilitates coordinated national action where that's appropriate. It needs to be grounded in common principles. It needs to be developed collaboratively. Remember that diverse mix of actors that's out there. It needs to be lean. It needs to be action-oriented. It needs to be focused on areas where we're better off acting together than we are acting independently. And so there are endless areas like that that we talked about in the last couple of days, questions of adaptation to climate change, the link between water and food, agricultural productivity and food security, the link to energy security, questions of transboundary resources, not only between Canada and the United States, but also within Canada, questions of basic data collection and sharing and monitoring, drinking water safety, especially on First Nations reserves, market opportunities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure we could all make a great list. So how do we get there, right? Are you about to show me a sign? No? Good. Excellent. All right. You had that about to show me a sign thing going on there. All right. So how do we get there, right? So I think one of the things that we, just to recap a few critical points, I think, that inform a little bit how we get there is, as a few people have noted already, I think we're in a moment in our history right now where I won't say that the stars have aligned, but I think they're aligning. They're lining themselves up. David Schindler was saying that he's been doing this for 45 years. He's got 25 years on me, but for 20 years, I've been a water nerd and interested in water, and I got interested in water because of the last big surge of national tension, which was the Inquiry on Federal Water Policy, and I had a chance to watch it all dribble away, interest evaporated. So many good puns, right? this is pretty big, right? And so, I mean, I'm a little suspicious. I've seen this play before. You know, I've seen the interest come. I've seen it go. But this is looking good because there's a whole bunch of new actors and new interests involved, too. The catch, of course, is that all of these various actors, including our governments, are motivated by all kinds of different interests and values, and that's one of the key pieces that we're going to have to address. These have to be clarified and balanced and addressed, at least, if not reconciled. And I think, third, the key theme, coming back to the theme of this panel, is that this is a governance challenge. No government on its own, not even all governments on their own, can create and deliver a national water strategy. In the current environment, I think the capacity does not exist. The number of actors who have the ability to influence outcomes is far larger than simply governments. And so this becomes a question of governance, of negotiation, of collaboration. Okay, so let's take advantage of the opportunity we have now to move while there's still room to move. As I said, there are a number of initiatives that are underway. The CWRA, for example, is launching a dialogue very soon. FLO is continuing with the excellent work that it's doing. The Canadian Council of Ministers of the Environment has been releasing some materials and taking some steps, and I think we're going to hear about some of those, so that's excellent. But I think, too, you know, we were talking this morning about the importance of leadership, and I completely agree that leadership is critical, but the problem, of course, of saying, okay, it's all about leadership is that it always ends up that someone has to do something. And so we're sitting around waiting for someone to do something. And I think that someone is us. We have to find a way to integrate concern for water, to integrate concern for water security into the day-to-day decision-making, the day-to-day business that goes on among all of these various actors, whether it's our governments, industry, citizens, municipalities, whatever. We have to find a way to integrate water as a basic decision-making consideration. I'll give you one tiny example. In Ontario, we have on the books, I was just checking on my mobile just before the talk started to see if it had received royal proclamation yet. And according to the e-law site, it hasn't. But we have this thing called the Sustainable Water and Sewage Systems Act in Ontario that, as far as I know, has not yet received royal proclamation. Steve's nodding. Excellent. Right? So this is full cost pricing, what Steve was talking about. But the important thing, too, is part of that statute would stretch the full cost pricing blanket over the costs of source water protection, for example, which could be very, very interesting if we start to view the cost of providing the water service as basic watershed management, the costs of that, incorporating that into the bill. And so what you're doing with a statute like that is you're kind of skirting around the whole question to change people's values and norms and ethics and whatnot, and you're putting in place some fundamental economic tools. It's just one tiny interest about an example, I should say, of making water part of the business. So I think this is an entirely tractable problem, this business of integrating concern for water into our day-to-day decision-making. As Karen was suggesting this morning, there really are lots of examples out there. We really are not leading the pack here on the file of taking a coordinated national approach. I like to stay in touch with what's going on in New Zealand, just to name one country, for example, which has had an interesting freshwater program of action, which has involved a coordinated national dialogue, integration between the national government, the Maori, the councils, and industry. They're sorting out common principles. They're finding ways in which they can address those water and economy connections. I mean, you know, everybody else is doing it, right? We can too, right? And so the solutions are out there. It is, as Minister Prentice was suggesting a few moments ago, it is a function of just will and finding the right tools and putting them in place. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Rob. The next speaker on the panel is Linda Nolan. Linda's bio is in your package. Linda is a public interest environmental lawyer and consultant, and among her long list of achievements is that she headed the West Coast environmental law for many years. Linda, welcome.
To the organizers of the conference. I'm very pleased to be here with so many colleagues from so many different work parts of my life. It's quite a challenge to come up with graphics for water governance, so this one I found, and I thought it was a good one. And it illustrates the theme that I'm going to focus on today, which is shared water governance, which I think can be one of the solutions to the governance challenge that we face today. So what is this photo show? It shows the poor lone regulator standing by himself with his briefcase full of laws, trying to make the decision all by himself. And this isn't going to work, and we know that. And there's a big move afoot, not only in Canada, but in a lot of other places in the world, to try and share governance. And what do I mean by that? This definition of water governance, we've talked about it. We haven't had a definition put up on the board, so this one is from Professor Backer, whose excellent presentation you heard this morning. And I'm not going to go through it, but it's there for you. This is a formal definition. I think more colloquially, we can say water governance is really about making decisions. Who sits at the table, and how do they make their decisions? And those two questions can seem complex, and they are different provinces in particular answer them in different ways. So shared governance, it also goes by many other names, and it's a pretty common theme in Canada today as well as elsewhere. It can be called delegated governance, collaborative governance, and devolved governance. And it does have a number of key characteristics. Rob's already mentioned a few, and I will not go through all the possible characteristics of shared water governance, but just focus in on two in particular. Greater participation both among government levels and also especially from those outside government. And the complexity, I think Rob covered that well, and so many of the other speakers have covered that as well, so I won't dwell as much on the complexity of the issues that shared water governance bodies can address, but I will emphasize the very important role that law plays, and especially I think I'm going to venture to say federal law. So when you're doing your audit and of federal responsibilities, take a look at the Canada Water Act, which I'm sure you're doing, and how well it's all the many powers it contains have been used, because the powers are there. They just haven't been used. So why do we want to engage on shared water governance? Well, think of that poor lone regulator standing by himself as the water's rising above him, climate change is upon him. But also think about the fights that are out there that are only going to get worse. There's already a lot of conflict over water in many parts of the country. There's conflict between different user groups, and this is only going to continue. Some of the most profound conflicts are going to be, and already are, between economic uses of water and the environment. Shared water governance takes many names. You may not know it by the name shared water governance, but I've just put up here some of the very many different names of new governance bodies that are used across Canada and in other parts of the world. So there's a lot of different names for this phenomenon. And here's where I'll do a little bit of the law. I don't know how well that shows up with the lights, but we've talked already about the overlapping constitutional responsibilities, and I won't go through them in detail. You're all quite familiar with the different ways that different levels of government work together. But, you know, think of an example. Think of one river body, and on that river, a provincial regulator will issue water licenses and enforce pollution control laws. A federal regulator will ensure that fisheries law is upheld and also make sure that navigation's unimpeded, make sure any cross-boundary issues are taken care of. A local government will enforce bylaws for flood protection and land use planning, among other things. And Aboriginal groups will practice traditional activities that are constitutionally protected, such as fishing. And Aboriginal water rights are an extremely important part of the Canadian mix, and I believe we'll have a speaker who will delve into this a little bit more in a later panel today. Bob Sanford did mention it and gave the example of the Piikani. Aboriginal water rights have yet to be fully defined by the courts. They are guaranteed by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which guarantees Aboriginal rights in Section 35. And Aboriginal water rights have been called the sleeping giant of Canadian water law. And if you start to follow the different disputes and the different lawsuits that are going on now, you'll see that this sleeping giant is starting to wake up. So I know everybody loves it when lawyers have pictures of laws. So here I've got a lovely picture of the legislation that applies to water in BC. So shared water governors, so shared water governance bodies, have to coordinate a lot of different laws. And this is just the BC example with the Water Act at the center. The other provincial acts are rounded in blue. The federal acts are listed in the yellow bubbles, and the delegated community local government laws are in the sort of orange bubbles. And even this isn't as complete as it could be. There are other laws that aren't contained in this diagram, which is from the BC Ministry of the Environment. And because we're in Quebec, I also wanted to include the list from Quebec. You heard a very interesting presentation from Professor Kuhman about the new Quebec water law, which is pretty unique in Canada, very unique, recognizing the right to water, the right for natural persons to have access to drinking water, providing no compensation if your right to withdraw is taken away, and really out at the forefront of shared water governance as well. So it's important to realize that here in Quebec, shared water governance is about to really take off with this new law passed last year. Here are some key characteristics of shared water governance. And again, I won't go through them all. I'm working on a primer on practicing shared water governance, plain language, short, accessible, that will be produced with my colleagues at the Program on Water Governance at UBC. So watergovernance.ca is the website. Lots of interesting material there, and it should be done in the next few months or so. But there are a number of key characteristics of these shared governance bodies, usually delegation to a multi-stakeholder group by government of powers, focusing on the watershed scale, greater participation, as I've mentioned, the use of collaborative decision-making, often striving for consensus if possible, and some provinces have actually put consensus decision-making provisions in their law. It's usually a default to voting if necessary. And then, of course, the use of science-based decision-making, which becomes more and more important. So here, the four provinces that I'm looking at in this primer are Quebec, Ontario, Alberta, and BC. Here is probably too small a font, but here is how they compare on with their different shared governance organizations, how they compare on actually specifying who needs to be at that table, one of those key questions that I said was fundamental for water governance, shared water governance. So in the new Quebec law, the law states quite specifically there must be balanced representation, and it goes on to list the sectors that need to be involved. Those include government, native, municipal, economic, environmental, agricultural, and community sectors. Ontario's Clean Water Act actually goes even farther in its source protection committees. It's specified by regulation that those committees must contain one-third municipal representatives, one-third from agriculture, commercial or industrial sectors, and one-third from environmental health and other interests of the general public. So that's quite specific. And environmental groups were the ones who advocated and got that environmental word in that provision. The two other examples that I'm looking at, the Watershed and Planning Advisory Councils and BC's Water Management Planning Committees, don't say in the law or policy what type of representation needs to be included. So they are much more discretionary. And it's interesting in that only the one example that is in effect in BC right now, in the township of Langley, a community that Professor Hans Schreier is extremely familiar with, the Water Management Planning Committee was quite narrow. It consisted of representatives from two provincial ministries, agriculture and environment, and the township itself. So not the type of wide, broad-based, balanced representation that you see specified in the laws of Ontario and Quebec. A different approach. More flexible, yes. Perhaps has some deficits as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit about science and shared water governance, just about the ability of shared water governance bodies, usually as a starting point, since they involve different levels of government, since they often involve scientists, community experts, local stewardship groups. One of their strengths is that they can draw upon a wide variety of existing evidence and also commission new scientific evidence. Often a starting point is to produce a state of the watershed report or some sort of compilation of all the scientific evidence, and this can be quite important for their success. And, you know, some of these themes have already been mentioned many times today. One of the important jobs that shared water governance bodies can perform is to try and make these trade-off decisions between competing water uses. Do fish have water rights, also known as in-stream flow protection, ecological flow protection, and a few other names? We've really fallen down in Canada. There is no jurisdiction, to my knowledge, in Canada which legislates in-stream flow protection. BC has promised to change that by 2012 in its Water Act modernization process. This, again, is an area where the federal government, with its fisheries powers, as well as its numerous other constitutional responsibilities for water, could really play a huge role. And already federal fisheries officers in many provinces do prepare and enforce guidelines about in-stream flow protection, but they're not legally required. Many other countries in the world do require them. This is a legal change that could, and in my opinion, should be made. It's amazing how often the Athabasca River has come up, and I don't have the detailed set of slides that Professor Schindler disturbed us all with yesterday. But again, deciding on competing allocations, it's ultimately the responsibility of government decision makers. But having a shared governance body that looks at all the competing uses and makes some general recommendations, not the final allocation decision, but some general sort of recommendations about how the water should be used can be very important. So this slide from the Pembina Institute on Athabasca River water use is quite graphic in showing that the vast majority of water withdrawn from the Athabasca is for oil sands. And that very tiny little fragment on the right hand of the screen for habitat enhancement, it's somewhat doubtful that that's going to be enough to protect in-stream flows for the Athabasca River. Interestingly, in Alberta, which has quite a voluntary system for its shared water governance, the regional watershed organizations are called watershed planning and advisory councils, and there is no watershed planning and advisory council for the Athabasca region. You would think that for the most water-stressed area, probably the most controversial resource extraction area in the province, that having this shared governance body would be a priority. And one, I understand, is for information, and maybe others from Alberta can confirm this. But it's quite startling that in this area there is no shared water governance body right now in effect. There's a lot of others. There's about 8 or 9 in effect in other parts of Alberta, but none up in this area. And in my opinion, and I am biased in favor of law, I might as well be upfront about it, if the Alberta Water Act actually specified that there needed to be these WPACs in every part of the province, then there would be one in the Athabasca. We wouldn't be 10 years later after the Bow River Basin has been in existence, maybe 20 years, waiting for one where it's so sorely needed in the Athabasca. And climate change, again, an issue that's been extremely well dealt with by my colleague Jim Bruce and others here today. Again, this is a very complex issue with multiple competing impacts on multiple sectors. This is just a sample issue about what could happen with lower water levels in the Great Lakes, one likely consequence of climate change. Look at all the sectors impacted, look at all the potential impacts of those sectors, and then look at the overall result, which basically, although called on this slide supply-demand mismatches, is basically conflict. Conflict and more conflict. And then, again, going back to the federal role, looking at the sectors that could be impacted, about half, if not more, are directly a federal responsibility. So the federal government needs to be at the table and isn't in these provincially formulated shared governance bodies to date. I think there's a real role for the federal government to play in looking at how it can support provincial efforts for shared water governance. It does happen in a few isolated projects across Canada, but it's not the standard behavior by any means. So I will end, again, referring to a law that's been referred to a number of times, the EU Water Framework Directive, passed in 2000, sets quite high environmental standards that must be complied with throughout Europe, every country in Europe, no exceptions. Every country needs to form shared water governance bodies. It could be river basin management committees or aquifer management committees, and try and attain these goals by set deadlines that are set in the law. If the EU can do it with their vastly differing set of countries, with vastly differing water resources, cultures, legal systems, surely we can do something similar here in Canada. Thank you.
Linda, thank you. And our last speaker, it's a great pleasure to introduce Ralph Pentland. He's really, with Jim Bruce, the two sort of architects of the of what one could say is among the heydays of federal engagement on water issues. He is the acting chair of the Canadian Water Issues Council, president of the Broward Enterprises Incorporated. He was a longstanding director of water planning management at Environment Canada before it was called Environment Canada, and he is the principal author of the federal water policy, which was tabled to Parliament in 1987. Ralph, it's a great pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you very much, Scott. I'd also like to thank the organizers of the conference. I personally learned a lot in the last couple of days. What I'd like to do is something a little different. I'd like to explore three concepts that seem to be good ideas at the time they were introduced, but may not be such good ideas now, or may need a little bit of recalibration. Those three concepts are sustainable development, so-called smart regulation, and theories about managing in an information age. Those seem to be different topics, but in my mind, they're three closely related parts of the pieces of the same puzzle. So let me start with the sustainable development. In 1987, the Brundtland Commission published its landmark document, Our Common Future. I just read that the other day again. The entire report was based on the assumption that humanity has the ability to make development sustainable, to ensure that it meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. That clearly implies limits of some sort. But what made the Brundtland concept different from previous theories of growth like the Club of Rome and so on was the added assumption that the limits themselves could be expanded through improved technology and social organization. In other words, the biosphere could absorb ever-increasing volumes of human activity through technological and institutional advances. And in fact, we can advance limits to some degree, expand limits. For example, with respect to water, we traditionally expanded limits by building dams, drilling wells. And as that potential diminished, we started to expand limits by raising productivity, increasing efficiencies, and managing waste better. There's also potential to expand limits by taking advantage of synergies between sectors. If we save water, we save energy. You've heard it before. If you save energy, you save water. But sustainable development infers that we'll never allow the level of economic activity to exceed the carrying capacity of a region or the globe, for that matter. Of course, everything is ultimately self-correcting. If ecological carrying capacity is exceeded, the level of economic activity will necessarily be jolted downward at some point through conflicts, price shocks, or other catastrophic events. We just witnessed one in a way that an energy price shock 3 years ago exposed an unregulated derivatives market which almost brought down the world's financial system. Just imagine if you had an energy shock and a food price shock at the same time about 10 years from now. In that sense, it can be argued that we're already heading down several unsustainable paths. Early in the 21st century, the pattern of human conflict is being fundamentally reshaped by uneven population growth, consequent migration pressures, geopolitical tensions linked to energy insecurity, widespread regional water shortages, and irreversible climate change. Why are we on several unsustainable paths a quarter century after the world community agreed on the concept of sustainable development? I'm just going to give you two possibilities, and I'm sure you have others, but one would be that a lot of people have used the expanded limits idea as a license to simply unfettered development on the mistaken assumption that advancing technology would automatically overcome all forms of resource scarcity. A second and more fundamental reason is the fact that as the economy globalized, decision-making moved both downward and upward at the same time. It drifted downward by simply downloading responsibilities to often ill-equipped local entities and at the same time hollowing out critical senior government capacity, and I'll come back to that. Unfortunately, above national governments, there are no democratic institutions. So as governance drifted upward, it drifted upward to a combination of multinational corporations and non-democratic entities like the IMF and the WTO. All of these entities tend to place a higher priority on short-term investor protection than they do on sustaining long-term public good. We heard about fiduciary duty this morning. A corporation has a fiduciary duty to its shareholders, and a government has a fiduciary duty to citizens. We've tended to blur that quite a bit. And governments now, I think, have a fiduciary duty, or think they have a fiduciary duty to shareholders, and often international shareholders. There's no doubt that sustainable development started out as a good idea, but sustainable development as it has evolved on the global and national scales has become a very risky proposition. I don't have time to go into the litany of global water woes, but I'll just mention two that I find particularly disturbing. One, there are now several hundred million people who depend on food grown with underground water that's not being replaced. And the second one is emerging research on environment health linkages. There was a recent report just a couple of weeks ago to the U.S. Congressional Committee on the latest research worldwide on this topic, and I found some of it quite scary, actually. Canada is, of course, in a better off than most other countries because of our relatively sparse population and generous endowment of resources. But the economic and environmental trends here are equally troublesome. In a recent article in the Globe and Mail, the recently retired clerk of the Privy Council commented on our economic trends as follows. Quote, Canadians have been trapped in a beguiling productivity trap for almost a generation. We work harder and harder, use up our resources faster and faster, while the trap keeps us less rich, less able to provide public goods, and less competitive. And more specifically related to water, according to recent polls that you've heard about in the last day or two, most Canadians think water is their most important resource, and 75% of them are concerned about the long-term supply and quality, and for very good reason. So the basic question, is sustainability even possible without crisis? And I think the jury's still out on that. Despite wishful thinking, sustainable development can't and will not be achieved by the invisible hand of the international marketplace alone. But the efficiencies of the free market are going to have to be a necessary part of the solution. So what we are going to need, and this is where the question mark comes in, we're going to need a major augmentation of science, policy, and regulatory capacities within governments, especially national governments, so that they can continually redefine the public policy space and incentive systems within which the efficiencies of the free market can most effectively be redirected to the goal of sustainability. Now I'd like to move to regulatory trends for a minute. As trade agreements were signed and the international competitiveness agenda took hold in the late 1980s, there were enormous pressures on governments to make regulation more efficient and more effective. That's across the board, not just environment. It's food safety, transportation, the whole range of things. In and of itself, that was a laudable goal with which none of us would disagree. But as we moved through the 1990s, the competitiveness agenda moved us from regulatory efficiency to minimalist regulation across all sectors. Elaborate analytical and procedure requirements were put in place, making the adoption of new regulations very difficult. There was also a strong reliance on affected economic interests to regulate the impacts of their own activities on the environment and public health and safety. More recently, based mainly on the advice of the business community, the Canadian government formally adopted what they termed SMART regulation. I think SMART has S-M-A-R-T, stands for five things, but Anyway, so-called smart regulation includes many of the characteristics of the minimalist approach while adding the idea of promoting the interests of regulated entities as explicit goals of regulatory activities. The idea of making regulation more efficient and effective was fine, and we have, in fact, made a lot of progress in that regard. But in my view, we went way overboard in blurring the distinction between the regulators and the regulated. A recent book by Bruce Scott from Harvard University entitled The Concept of Capitalism questions the idea that capitalism can be just a one-level system governed by markets. He stresses, using sports analogies, that the freedom to compete must necessarily be conditional on playing by the rules, and points to the need for three strong and independent levels of governance: rule makers, rule enforcers, and game players. In recent years, we have somewhat compromised the roles, the capacity, and the independence of rule makers and rule enforcers. And as a result, it could be credibly argued that both democracy and capitalism have been at least somewhat diminished. Unfortunately, things have probably progressed too far to simply go back and correct our mistakes. At this juncture, we'll likely need more comprehensive regulatory reforms which explicitly recognize that certain natural resources, especially air, fresh water, and oceans, are central to our very existence. For that reason, governments will eventually have to accept that they have a continuing fiduciary duty to sustain the essence of those resources into perpetuity for the use and enjoyment of the entire population, somewhat akin to the public trust laws that they have in every state south of the border. Sustainable development and more efficient regulation are both examples of good ideas in need of recalibration. I'd like to touch on just one more. About the same time as sustainable development was touted as the way to overcome limits to growth, new theories also emerged about managing in an information age. Most of those theories suggested that the balancing of social, economic, and environmental interests should take place in an integrated way at a relatively local level, in the case of water and related resources, mostly at a watershed level. Senior governments would no longer try to impose all manner of sector-specific local solutions, but they would ensure a sufficient national knowledge capacity and exercise leadership in synthesizing, interpreting, and disseminating useful and appropriate information. They would also provide local entities with clear policy and regulatory frameworks that would ensure the wider interests of society were respected. In return, citizens, broadly defined, would make responsible decisions and take responsible actions. Good theory. Unfortunately, the theory remains largely untested. First, because subsequent reductions in national science capacity and increasingly risk-averse public services made knowledge less rather than more readily available to citizens. Second, because international pressures aimed at removing impediments to international competitiveness made rulemaking and enforcement both less transparent and less predictable. And third, because we lost many of the public participation opportunities that were open to citizens under a plethora of intergovernmental arrangements in previous decades. So what are the implications of these trends for water policy and water governance? From time to time, I hear someone say that the 1987 federal water policy is still mostly relevant, and all it needs is a bit of updating, a little fine-tuning. I don't think it's that simple. The world and Canada's place in that world is very different than they were when we wrote the 87 policy. Water sector managers have since been overwhelmed by forces outside the sector and outside the country and the hollowing out of national environmental science and policy capacity. We do need water policy reform to strengthen and better integrate top-down knowledge and policies with bottom-up decision-making and action. But that reform needs to be to at least recognize and hopefully contribute to broader public policy reforms beyond just the water sector. For that and other reasons, meaningful water policy reform may be a little ways off yet. In the meantime, water managers at a river basin or local level are left with a dilemma. They're struggling with difficult issues, many of which extend beyond their regions, often without the scientific, policy, regulatory, and financial support that they need and probably should be expecting from their more senior governments. I find it interesting, I've heard it a couple times today too, that local water managers across Canada are more and more often using the term water security rather than sustainability. I suspect that's because it's a fallback position. Because security seems more tangible, objective than sustainability, given the fact that transient adaptation to largely uncontrollable forces is rapidly becoming the essence of local water management. What can water managers do, at, say at the level of a river basin, when they're faced with unpredictable and largely uncontrollable things like climate change, exponentially accelerating non-renewable resource extraction, and a growing array of health-threatening pollutants, and at best uncertain top-down governance? I would suggest that what they should do is hope for the best but plan for the worst. What they can do is focus on maximizing the resilience of local ecosystems to cope with the unknown and the uncontrollable by dealing as effectively as they can with what is known and what is within their control. The most obvious candidates are, of course, keeping water within its natural watershed boundaries, treating it with respect, it and its watersheds with respect, and using it as efficiently as possible. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I'm. This feels a little to me like Ottawa, is that there's a range of views that have been expressed, so I feel entirely at home. I'm not going to try to sum up, but I will. I want to pose a question which I heard from all three panelists, and that is your views on the role of science or evidence in relation to try to solve some of the complexities that are before us. So we heard from Rob that what, well, first of all, I mean, we just heard as well from Ralph that the 1987 water policy can't be dropped in again because of the external forces from outside Canada, because of sectoral interests and other actors, which very much echoes what Rob had said in terms of the inherent complexities of the issues we're dealing with. And whether or not whether the role of science has some special arbitrating role in the same way that I think Linda had summarized in the governance models, whether or not conflicts can inherently be overcome, resolved by not only who's at the table, but what I see and what type of evidence is discussed when the players are at the table. So that would be a common question I would have for all three panelists. But I wanted to also just repeat something that I think Rob said at the very beginning, because it is a sign of hope, and that is that the stars are aligned, which I think is a, you know, a wonderful message, and also we can too. There's all sorts of models. You use the model from New Zealand.
I sound like Obama.
Well, you do sound like Obama, but I didn't say yes, we can. But it very much is in that tone of that of hope. And so maybe I have a twofold question. One is fairly complicated, which is the role of science, and I was very interested this morning, the colleague from Quebec talking about the new Quebec law mentioned the issue of precautionary principle, the precautionary approach. There are conferences that go on for days on what this means in application, what weight of evidence is, how much evidence is needed, how much you make decisions which are outside of evidence-based, what evidence-based actually means. So that would be my first general question on the role of science, and then more generally, Rob's question on are we all equally optimistic? And I think especially given Ralph's, I think your threefold examples on has sustainable development been a concept that's lost its meaning and unsustainability is potentially out of control because of different triggers, and are smart regs gone too far in terms of flattening regulatory oversight to try to put some brakes on unchecked development? So maybe I'll go in order of Rob, if you're first, since you were the most hopeful.
I'm usually accused of being relentlessly pessimistic, so this is an entirely new role for me here to be the spear carrier for hopeful. The question of science is incredibly important. Good decisions in the water realm depend on a good understanding of the natural system, the social system. We're just groping blindly in the absence of the scientific information we need. But, and there's a big but, one of the key characteristics, I think, of decision-making in the contemporary world of water is that so much of it is negotiated. So from my perspective, I view science as a critical foundation for good decision-making, but the reality, of course, is that because we're talking about rights and responsibilities and interests, et cetera, that it's an inherently negotiated process as well. You see this in a lot of examples of collaborative decision-making. For example, catchment management authorities that are working in Australia to define the level of environmental flows that are supposed to be provided first. You would think that it would simply be a function of asking the biologist, and they'll tell you what the level should be. And, of course, the way the process works is the biologist tells you what the level should be, and then you negotiate what it can actually be as a function of the different kinds of knowledge that people bring to the table. And so often you end up in a realm where the, especially where there's a lot of uncertainty, is where you have to engage in a process of co-production of knowledge, where people try to identify the concerns that they're interested in and find that common basis so that it's not your data versus my data and we're in front of a board or a panel. So I mean, in a nutshell, I think that's where it is. I think it's naive to think that if we only had perfect data, we could make perfect decisions. Of course not. But it's equally naive to think that we can make good decisions in the absence of good data. Do you want to do one at a time? Or?
Sure.
Yeah, let's do one at a time.
Yeah, Linda?
Okay, well, I completely agree with what you said, Rob, and I'll just follow up that example with a Canadian one, which I was going to use before you even started. But it's fine. The scientific study was done in the South Saskatchewan River Basin about what was needed for in-stream flow protection, and there was a pretty clear answer about the number that was needed. But the shared governance body, the Watershed Planning and Advisory Council, decided not to use that number. There was already a huge number of water licenses that had been given out on that system. There were concerns if some of those licenses were taken away to allow the in-stream flows to be protected, the government might have to pay compensation. And so there was a negotiated result which did take the science into account but didn't actually follow the recommendation. I would actually prefer some of the science to be legislated, as I mentioned. I think there's, if you have pretty clear scientific evidence about what you need to protect rivers, why not put that into law? I mean, we do it in other cases. Why can't we do it for water? So, roll for science, but maybe not given enough weight.
Maybe just a kind of a theoretical answer, I guess. The role of science in a market economy, or government science in particular, if you're going to get to either sustainability or security in a market economy, there's a certain model that has to work. You have to be able to define a feasible policy space by defining constraints or limits on what the private sector can do and individuals can do. And that those limits, that policy space, and those limits may expand or contract over time. They're going to change over time, so you have to keep redefining that policy space. And within that policy space, you can let the free market find an efficient solution, which it will if you let it. But you have to, because the free market is imperfect in many ways, you have to also impose some incentives and disincentives on the market system within that policy space. So you need both physical science and social science, neither of which we have enough of. Our science capacity in governments at all level is probably about 30% below what it was in 1987, approximately 30% below. And we definitely don't have the science in government, and we do need it some in government because outside government is seldom independent enough, unfortunately. So we do need more science to make that kind of model work in a market economy.
Great, thank you. And then the second part of them will open up for questions, and I think we have about 30 minutes, which is great. So the second part is Rob's overarching sense of optimism. And
can I qualify that?
You can.
Call it hopeful. Hopeful in the sense that conditions exist now that I haven't seen previously, but also a little suspicious and cynical because, you know, as I said, things seemed very exciting when Ralph was working on the federal water policy. It seemed that we were really stepping out as a country and we were ready to roll. And it is, you know, the story was not good following that. That's a very interesting tale, how we ended up with the Where's Water Committee that Karen was talking about. But I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic, but at the same time, I'm realistic in the sense that that it's entirely within our power to make a mess of this if we fail to put in place the basic institutional and other considerations that we need to get in while the getting is good is what it comes down to. So tempered optimism.
Uh, Probably a mix of optimism and pessimism. I'm optimistic when I see promises to do things like legislate in-stream flow protection in BC by 2012, probably the first in Canada. So that's a clear legislative promise. But then I see the government of BC with its latest budget cutting the environment ministry yet again. And I think, well, how are you going to do this? How on earth can you pass a law and enforce it if you don't have the people there on the ground to do the job? So a mix, back and forth.
Yeah, I think if you allow me to use the solution of crisis, I'm optimistic. We will have enough crises that we will get there. There's one exception to that I have to make is that the environment health thing worries me a lot, and I'm not sure even crisis can help us there. If you think, for example, that globally sperm counts are 50% lower than they were 50 years ago, is that trend going to go for another 50 years? And then the problem would surely be solved.
Well, this conference uses very colorful metaphors. I'm not even going to comment on it. We are going to open this up. I wanted to thank the panel. We have time for questions. So the floor is open, and maybe we could start with a gentleman. I'll try to keep order. The gentleman right there. Yes, sir. Yeah. Right there.
David Brooks, Friends of the Earth Canada. You've all had experience with various thoughts about federal water policy. There's been, I think we can approach a consensus that we need a federal water policy. If you were suddenly given by a prime minister the directive to create a federal water policy, how would you structure that process? And how much time would you give for the report? How much time are you going to get, and how are you going to structure to create, let me say, a draft federal water policy?
I would do it the way I did it last time. I would hire somebody like Peter Pearson, but I would recognize today that a federal water policy really couldn't be written by water experts. Basically, your water problems, your environmental problems, are economic problems, and somehow I would have a different mix of people involved. You can't really get to solutions to our very fundamental sustainability problems by looking at water in the isolation from broader societal problems. It would contribute. I read a paper just before Copenhagen that said it would be really good if this conference failed because they're just going to agree to targets and not meet them anyway. Wouldn't it be better if it failed and then we really had to deal with things like incorporating environmental costs into things and democratizing international institutions, things that would really get us to a solution? And my reaction was no. We shouldn't make it fail, but we should do the right things for climate, and doing the right things for climate will contribute to the solutions to broader social and economic problems. And I could say the same for water. If we got to the right water solutions, they would also contribute to broader societal solutions.
Okay, good. I think if I may, yeah, please.
Stephen Renzetti, Brock University. For Linda first and then the other panelists, I think one of the challenges of public participation is that you end up sometimes with people who are representative but not average. They represent a sector or a group, but they're just not average. And so given the slides you presented, you know, I wonder about what is the optimal balance between having representatives but then just interested average folks? And what do you think is the optimal balance there?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and there's definitely a room for broad public consultation as well as more specifically representative participation in the actual decision-making process. I don't know if I can be precise about what the optimal balance is. I don't think it's enough to just have a watershed council that contains representation from all the sectors that you could think of, I think then you need to go out to the public and do pretty thorough public consultation. And that is one of the – I maybe criticized Alberta a little, and poor Alberta has been criticized a lot at this conference. So in Alberta's in their favor, they engaged in a very lengthy and broad-based public consultation when they were developing the Water for Life policy, and they still, from what I can see across the border in BC, they still do very broad-based, open public consultation. I'm afraid to say that my own province has not been as good on either front, the involving broad sectors or doing open and transparent public consultation for the current Water Act modernization. The consultation meetings are by invitation only, which I think is not acceptable in this day and age, and you won't get the average concerned citizen who may have very valuable input and local knowledge to contribute.
Yeah, I appreciate your Alberta comment, because one of the things that I find interesting about Alberta that is often not remembered is, and somebody please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the first public involvement body with a mandate to direct the government, the Environment Conservation Authority, was created in Alberta in, was it 1972? And Alberta has a long history of public involvement that is reflected in the some of the institutions we're seeing today, you know, along with a lot of other concerns. But in answer to Steve's question, I think anybody that voluntarily comes to a body like this is no longer representative. Unless you randomly select people from the general population, they're not going to be representative. And I go back and forth on that one. I sometimes think that's a mixed herring. I think mixed metaphor, maybe red herring. mixed herring. Good heavens. Okay, that'll be memorable. Write that one down. Obama would never make that mistake. When I think of the source protection committees in Ontario, for example, as Linda was mentioning, the regulation identifies the categories of people that need to show up, and so you got to find, you know, X number of farmers, X number of industry people, X number of people who are just representing the general public, and X number of First Nations if reserves exist in the territory. And the challenge for the committees has always been to find the people who will, maybe they came as a farmer or as the aggregate industry representative, but then they transform themselves into viewing themselves as being there for the broader public interest. And talking to the chairs of these committees, that process actually does unfold. Sometimes it takes a year of meetings before people begin to leave their interests somewhat behind and come to represent things more collectively. But it seems to me in these kinds of processes, that's often more the important part is whether or not people are coming to participate in something for the collective good rather than just, you know, for the sector they're representing or some general representativeness of the general population.
There's not much to add, but I think, you know, there's a lot of good progress being made, as we've heard, in horizontal integration at a very local level without the support they need. But I don't know how you're going to deal with big issues like climate change and tar sands and environment health things at a local level. I really don't. So I think you're still going to need a lot of vertical integration, which we just don't have. We used to have through multi-jurisdictional agreements, and we had a lot of those. In a 20-year period, we probably had 100 of those, or at least 100 of those. But without both the horizontal and the vertical integration, I don't think you can deal with the kind of problems we're trying to deal with today.
And just to follow up on Ralph's point, I think that's a very important one, because I wouldn't want anybody walking away thinking that I think anybody is recommending that everything should be moving down to the local level. I think Karen introduced the words that we were looking for earlier, which is subsidiarity and the idea of having things undertaken at the lowest appropriate level. And from my point of view, that's not something that you can determine based solely on the nature of the activity or the function. I think that actually varies from place to place as a function of the capacity that can be demonstrated. So, again, speaking to an Ontario example, Justice O'Connor, in his recommendations regarding how source protection should proceed, was using as a model the Grand River Conservation Authority, which is not representative of all conservation authorities. It's the one who won the Teese River Prize. It has enormous depth and capacity relative to other conservation authorities. And so one of the challenges in implementing the Clean Water Act has been recognizing the variability in the abilities of the different committees. Some of the regions of Ontario simply do not lack the technical sophistication or the experience in public involvement, for example, right? And so I would completely endorse what Ralph is saying. There are some regions where a local actor may be able to deal with a particular issue, and there are others where we need to be sophisticated enough to say, no, this needs to stay at a different level. And sort of the problem is, of course, if you like consistency and uniformity, and you prefer, you know, this entire function is going to go over here, then you're not going to like that model because that works quite against that. But I don't think that's the way to go, that sort of the simple-minded saying this function always here at this particular level.
Keith.
Hi, Keith Heifel from the University of Waterloo. First of all, let me say congratulate the three speakers. Very nice presentation and excellent chair. The question that, or comment first, and then a question that I'd like to bring up, I think it goes in the direction that you were mentioning, Ralph, sort of the broader social issues. And two things that are very important are meaningful jobs and wealth creation. And often we refer to that as value added. So if you take a look at Canada as a whole, we have a lot of natural resources. Many of it, they just take out of the ground, export on process, so we lose the technology, we lose the jobs. Forestry industry, we don't even make chainsaws, and we have such a great resource. So I look at water, and let's take a look at the example of the oil sands. There, of course, they're using a lot of water, but apparently now they're shipping the bitumen on process, on refined to the United States, so we lose the technology, we lose the jobs, we lose the profit. So I wonder if you'd like to comment the opportunities you see for Canada in this whole problem area of value added. And before I let you answer that, let me just make one comment here. One area where we did very well was our nuclear industry with our CANDU reactors and selling them all over the world. The current government that was represented here today is going to privatize AECL. It'll probably be the end of our nuclear industry. So we're destroying our value added. So with respect to water, what do you see?
Professors usually feel compelled to speak when confronted with a microphone and often get going without actually having thought it through. I may try and resist that tendency, but I don't know. I mean, I guess I think we do actually use water and add value to the water in a tremendous range of functions already. But I guess what you're talking about is part of the larger dialogue of the hollowing out of manufacturing and the branch plant economy, et cetera, et cetera. So honestly, Keith, I'm just going to stop babbling right now.
Well, I think it's not so much value added in the water sector. It's more. If you get the model right, I talked about the model where the government and the private sector work together within this feasible policy space and appropriate incentives and disincentives. You should theoretically move both the economy and the environment forward at the same time. You can't. We're doing neither now. We're moving both of them backwards. But in theory, you should move both of them forward simultaneously if you get the model right. It's not a question of looking at the water. It's a question of getting the economy and the environment. That's what we're all here for. Working together properly, and then you'll get your value added. You won't get it in the water sector. You'll get it in every other sector of the country.
You know what? I actually have half a decent idea. All right. Okay. Now, upon reflection, I think one of the opportunities, it comes back to this idea I floated very briefly of, do we have a water competitive advantage in certain areas? And just a small anecdote that I'm not even going to stand behind the example, but it simply is telling of the kind of dialogue that we're not having. But having a discussion with an official from Ontario's agriculture ministry about the need for an irrigation strategy in Ontario. Ontario is not exactly the irrigation heartland, but the goal of the discussion was to try and ensure that any thought of expanding irrigation was framed in the context of of the nature and sustainability of the water resources that were available, et cetera, so that you could have a realistic discussion about whether or not water resources, in addition to all the other infrastructure, were available. So obviously we don't want an irrigation strategy that results in greater degradation of habitats. But one of the points that this gentleman brought up was the idea that climate change, for example, is expected to devastate the apple industry in western United States, in Oregon, in Washington. And so his question to me was, is there a market opportunity for Ontario's apple industry based on use of additional water? I don't have a clue. I don't know if that's a good idea. But we are so far from having the ability to answer questions like that and formulate sensible policy at this stage. And I think that's just a tiny example of a dialogue that occurs in other jurisdictions where they're able to ask and answer those kinds of questions that we are not at this stage. And so when we talk about, you know, the kinds of data and information we need, I mean, that needs to be part of the discussion as well, I think.
Yes, in the back there, please.
Hi. Sorry about that. I'd like to address my question to Mr. Pentland. My name is Matthew, and I work with the Committee for the Republic of Canada, meaning we spend a lot of our time in my organization basically demonstrating to people, especially those who use computer models to try to shape nonlinear systems like human societies, which behave on fundamental principles like creativity and things which don't measure up very well in a linear computer model that has certain axioms like carrying capacity, inherent limits to growth in the model itself. Now, I'm glad you brought this up in your presentation because my view when looking at the world right now, which I'm cusping in the economic crisis, and you said that there will be many other crises to come, and I don't think this has happened overnight but over the course of a good series of decades, where now finally the global system is going through a phase of collapse. And we have two different diametrically opposing ways of looking at the solution. Where on the one hand, what we're seeing from Eurasia, China, Russia, India, South Korea, Jordan are embarking on large-scale investments into nuclear energy, transportation, frontier technologies. And this makes an approach which is breaking from the econometric and other computer models, which we are not doing in Europe, in Canada, in the States. And my question here is, why do you think that we have such antagonism towards breaking with the models and instead choosing to balance carrying capacities and balance finite resources instead of creating new resources like fusion, frontier technology that would allow for desalination en masse, and things like space exploration, which is also being pushed right now across Eurasia for things like helium-3, which is bountiful upon the moon, and instead thinking about confining these things and modifying human behavior under a one-world government or other forms of supranational authorities. So that's my question, and I was hoping you could possibly offer some insight, and any of you are welcome to join and throw in your two cents.
Ralph.
I'm not sure your point, I think. Is your point that somehow technology can solve all our problems if we let it, or we give it a chance?
You could do it briefly. That would be great.
Yeah, human creativity is not technology by itself, but human creativity in terms of discovering principles underlying the universe, like fusion, which manifest in technological upgrades. Yeah,
we certainly will do that. Technology will advance, and limits will advance with technology. But the problem is we have social and political and legal systems that advance much slower, and therefore we can't. The technology ends up doing more harm than good often. I remember talking to an engineer, somebody in an engineering firm one time, and I talked to him about energy shortages. He said, "That's no problem. We'll put a big lens up in the sky, and it'll deflect all." My answer was, "Yeah, if we can do something wrong, we will." And you know, if you. It's just so. I think technology will naturally advance, but I think our biggest problems are our legal and political and economic systems advance much slower, and they don't keep up. And so, if they don't keep up, the technology is causing more harm than good. It's to keep these other systems, get these other systems caught up with technology. I don't worry about technology advancing; it will advance. But the problem is, right now, it's advancing too fast for the other systems.
Great, thank you. Yes, please.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm from CKUT. My question is sort of the way that people have been discussing water has been from either a scientific or sort of a profit loss viewpoint, which both makes sense. But since most of the world has sort of agreed that water is about as close to a human right as Canada is willing to let it become in the UN, I know that a moral view is really tough to take in a governance statute. For instance, to quote someone from the last talk, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. But since it's seen as sort of a human right, it's definitely necessary. Everyone's acknowledged that. Is there any move within governance to make a minimum amount of potable water available for those necessary reasons? Not necessarily like a profit loss scheme, but, you know, we need this much to live or this much to continue our ecosystems as a base, in the same way that social policies involve different races or something like that as a foundation of their policies. I'm just wondering if there's any movement towards that vibe.
Yeah. Linda first.
Yeah. Well, I think that the Quebec law that I referred to is a pretty good step in that direction. It does recognize, I think, the right of every natural person to have access to water, and then it goes on to qualify what that type of water would be. Whether or not Canada agrees, it's pretty agreed among the rest of the world that water is almost certainly a human right, whether in its own form or as part of the other international human rights treaties and declarations. I think there's no doubt a huge moral dimension to water, and it can't be summarized in purely economic terms. You know, in my field, law, it's not very usual to talk about a moral dimension, but I think the fact that the new Quebec law talks about the precautionary principle, refers to the right of natural people to have water, I think it's very interesting that it specifically chose to focus on the right of every natural person, not every person, because that would have included corporations, to have access to a certain amount of water. That's definitely, I think, an example of what you're looking for. And other laws in other parts of the world have specifically recognized the human right to water. And in South Africa, for example, there is a designated amount per person per day which has to be given free, as far as I know.
Just to comment briefly, the question of water as a human right, I often listen to many debates between David Brooks and Maud Barlow on this topic. So I think they're coming together a little bit, maybe. It's a difficult question. When you talk about water as a human right, I mean, we all would all like to see that happen, but there may be practical circumstances where it can't happen. But what I see as a practical solution is water as a public trust. I mean, if you assume that governments have a fiduciary duty to preserve the essence of water for the use and enjoyment of the entire population today and tomorrow, That's all you can do. That's all you can do for sure. You have a fiduciary duty to do as much as you can. You don't necessarily have a duty to do what you might not be able to do.
I would take a little bit of issue too with what you said in the very beginning, and I have a feeling maybe you didn't mean it that way. But I think there's absolutely no reason why a deeply moral view, the values that we wish to advance, cannot be embedded in legislation and in the ways in which we govern. In fact, I'd go so far to say is that all legislation represents a particular view, even if it isn't stated explicitly. But I think the point you make is you know, leaving aside the question of whether or not it should, you know, water as a human right should be incorporated, et cetera. I think the larger question is what are the principles? What are the common principles? What is the vision that we wish to share? I mean, this is one of the, if you're thinking about a national vision and strategy for water, of course, the trick is to figure out, well, it can't be simply the nuts and bolts pieces. I mean, it will be about data sharing protocols and all this sort of jazz, but it's also about larger questions of how we wish to describe and capture our relationship with water and the environment and the world and all of these considerations. And I think to pretend that if we go down that road and we pretend that we're not doing that, I think we're being a little bit disingenuous, because we most certainly are, even if, you know, we don't write it down in the position that we're taking. So I would prefer that we be upfront about it. So I think it's a very nice reminder of a dimension of governance that is absolutely critical.
So let me just add a they're very, very interesting examples in South America as well, which very much reflect, I think, the process Rob has just described. Brazil, for example, set up a special water parliament. They took 2 years of consultations. They've set up interbasin water councils, and water as a human right is enshrined in that constitution as well as enshrined in other constitutions in South American countries. So I think your last point about the organizing principles, Then from that, they then create the technicalities which are worked out at the legal, regulatory, and other sides. But it's a very, very interesting debate. And with that, I am going to close this panel and thank all our panel, Rob and Linda and Ralph. Thanks very, very much. I've enjoyed this.
We have... I think just experienced a tremendous discussion, great presentations by the panelists, and a finely moderated piece. We will be breaking now for 15 minutes. Please be back in your seats at 3:45 when you'll listen to the Minister, Charlene Johnson.